Well, good evening. So this is hours 9 and 10. We're combining Daniel into Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. Chuck Missler, in his book, Learn the Bible in 24 Hours, he does Daniel separate because there's a lot of material there. And I will have given you a lot of material as well from him in there as well. So let's pray and let's get going. Father, we thank you for this time together. We ask in the name of Jesus that we be filled with your Spirit, that we would be illuminated by your Spirit as we go through your Word. Help us to remember we're doing an overview of every book in the Bible, fitting it all together as we go. And just to help us with this process of building this 66-room house we call the Bible. And we praise you and thank you and bless you in Jesus' name. Amen. So this will be the largest body of Scripture that we'll go through these four major prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. And major refers to the book's size, not its significance. And minor prophets also include many treasures. They just happen to be smaller in size, hence minor. The major prophets are, of course, Isaiah, the messianic prophet, Jeremiah, the divine judgment upon the nations, including Israel, Ezekiel, the coming restoration, Daniel, the times of the Gentiles. There's a lot of ways you can designate or pigeonhole these books. You have a little graph there showing the kings and where these prophets are. Your lower left-hand corner, you have the major prophets. I would also put Uzziah down also in as with Isaiah as well as where he is. And so that's for your benefit and edification. So one page down, right? The book of Isaiah, and a lot of the material that we're using comes from Morgan, from his Analyzed Bible, and from Chuck Missler and Learn the Bible in 24 Hours. I want to give credit where credit's due. Morgan, Isaiah was a prophet of Judah. He exercised his ministry solely within her borders for her correction and for her comfort. His burdens of the nations were uttered concerning those who surrounded and harassed Judah. One of the characteristics of all four of these major prophets, and to an extent also the minor prophets, is that they're not only prophesying foretelling the word of God to Israel, but their major portions of their prophecy have to do with nations that either were at enmity with Israel or that were used by God to chasten Israel. And he has a lot to say about the nations. Profoundly conscious of the intention of God that through his people, all nations, all people should be blessed. The intent of God was that Israel would be the light and a witness to the nations, and that they would then desire and want to come to know the Lord. And how'd they do with that? Not too well. Okay. He saw through all judgments to the ultimate blessing of the whole earth, both Jew and Gentile. So there's a lot about salvation of Gentiles in the Old Testament, but nothing about the church. Nothing about the church being a singular body of Jew and Gentiles. That is a mystery revealed in the New Testament. The time of Isaiah. Isaiah's messages were delivered during a dark period in the history of the people. He lived and taught during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Contemporary with him, Hosea was prophesying to Israel in the north, and Micah to Judah as well. So Micah would have been a parallel prophet in Judah along with Isaiah. The book naturally falls into three major pieces: prophecies of judgment 1 through 35, historical interlude involving King Hezekiah 36 through 39, prophecies of peace 40 through 66. Judgment always comes before what? peace. Peace. Okay? Prophecies of judgments. Judgment 1 through 35. The prophecies of judgment move in three circles. The first circle, the inner smallest circle, deals with Judah and Jerusalem. The second with the nations of the world. And the third with the chosen people and the world. The first circle, chapters 1 through 12. Messages delivered during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, and Ahaz. The first five chapters contain messages delivered during Uzziah's reign. The prophet first impeached the whole nation. Remember, they were very prosperous. This was a very prosperous, materially prosperous people. They were also very religious. They went to church on Sunday and worshiped idols throughout the week. The prophet impeached the whole nation. He uttered Jehovah's complaint that Israel does not know. My people do not consider. They don't know, and they don't consider. He appeals to them to learn wisdom from their stricken condition. Oh, why are these things happening to me? Maybe I better look at my relationship with the Lord and see what's going on. He then proceeded in the name of Jehovah to correct their false notions of religion and true spirituality. He sought righteousness and judgment, not satisfaction with the external. You know, a lot of people come to church, and if their external life is going well, they look and do well at church. Often. But the issue has to be issues of righteousness and truth and love and judgment, and not just being satisfied with your material life. Okay. Isaiah then described the corruption of the city and the consequent judgment, declaring at the same time that there is a judgment, which is reprobation for persistent sin. The prophet appealed, and it's not persistent sin that they repented of and done again, but they just persist in sin and never repent. That's pretty heavy. The prophet appealed to them by describing the latter days in which the Lord's house is established. The law is to proceed from Zion, and the issue is to be peace, appealing to them to desist from evil. So God, through Jeremiah, sets up the standard, and then ask the people to do what? To measure what's going on currently with the standard of what will be in the kingdom age. Then he described the judgment of a corrupt society, of unjust rulers, and the corrupt people under them. He declared the judgment of Jehovah must fall upon the women who were haughty, luxurious, whose influence had been evil in the life of the nation. Women have a lot to do with the livelihood of what's going on in the nation. His appeal ends in another latter-day vision describing its prosperity, purity, and its mighty protection from the Lord. Finally, he denounced the nation, first by singing to them the song of the vineyard. We were talking about songs earlier, and showing how utterly they had failed to fulfill the divine purpose, pronouncing woes against monopoly, dissipation, unbelief, moral confusion, perversion of justice. Because of these things, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people. The prophet foretold the coming of the scourge upon them and the land. Part two, the circle, the messages of Isaiah during the reigns of Jotham and Ahaz, chapters 6 through 12. When Uzziah died, Isaiah was called to the exercise of a larger ministry, and that's dealt with in chapter 6, prepared for by the special vision granted to him. He was at once at the center of worship, he who heard the sigh of the sinner in his need, the center of worship. He was caught up. He encountered then obstinate Ahaz, who was the successor to Uzziah as a king. He foretold the judgment of Judah, not Jerusalem, though, by the Assyrian hosts. They came close, but they didn't take Jerusalem. After this encounter, the prophet turned from his more public ministry. He was instructed to bind the testimony and to seal the law. His children were to be for signs and wonders to the people, as Hosea's children were as well. He described the falsity and disaster of seeking familiar spirits and wizards. He then delivered to them the message of hope with a glorious description of the coming deliverer, followed by a four-part prophecy of judgment on Israel, each ending with the word, these words: For all this his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. There'll be more judgment. He does not relent in his judgment. The prophecy of judgment upon Assyria comes next in order. Assyria was used by Jehovah for the punishment of his people in the north and into Judah. Okay. Jehovah's intention was that the Assyrian should be the rod in his hand, his instrument. Assyria's intention, though, was to do what? Destroy the people of God. Therefore, Assyria must also be judged, though an instrument used to judge his people. The second circle, 13 through 27, prophecies concerning the nations of the world. Okay, he first described the doom of Babylon in 13 through 1423. The Medes were to be the instrument of the destruction of Babylon. The issue thereof was intended to be the restoration of Israel through the compassion of Jehovah. A five-part song which celebrates Babylon's downfall comes next, the first of which describes the overthrow and consequent rest of the whole earth. So this is speaking about a larger Babylon than just the one of Isaiah's day. The second speaks of the consternation of the underworld at the fall of Babylon. The third declares the sin which culminates in such destruction in Babylon. The fourth is the completeness of the destruction of Babylon. The fifth strophe announces the utter extermination of Babylon. And that never happened. So that is yet to happen. There follows a fragment concerning Assyria in 14, 24 through 27. The prophet reaffirmed Jehovah's intention to break its power. Prophecy concerning Philistia, the Philistines, always a thorn in the side of Israel. 14, 28 through verse 32 is a warning spoken to her. Although she oppressed the people of God, she was herself in peril. She was not to rejoice because the rod which smote her was broken. Whoever the rod was that was chastising her was broken. There were other forces at the disposal of Jehovah, and they threatened her. The prophecy concerning Moab in chapters 15 through 16 commences by describing her desolation. A catastrophe would overtake her, the result of which would be the mourning of her people. Yet she would be called upon to hide God's outcasts from the spoiler. From the spoiler. And Moab is where Petra is. Okay? Well, the Jews will flee the desolation abomination. The burden of Damascus, chapter 17, verses 1 and 2. The prophet had in mind the alliance which had been entered into by Israel or Ephraim with Damascus. The doom of Damascus would mean the destruction of the fortress of Ephraim. The prophet then proceeds to describe that very judgment of Ephraim in 17, 3 through 11, which would follow the destruction of Damascus, the effect being the compelling men to look to Jehovah rather than idols. The reason of this judgment was because Ephraim had forgotten God, her maker. Then there's a soliloquy by the prophet. If you're familiar with Shakespeare always had a lot of soliloquies in his writings, so he wasn't the first, which falls into two sections. The first reveals his consciousness of the opposing peoples and of Jehovah as a perfect defense. On the one hand, those who opposed him. On the other hand, the Lord is his defense. The second is a proclamation to ambassadors who were to return to their people to wait for Jehovah. Immediately following this soliloquy, we have the burden of Egypt. Again, another country that has touched his people in chapters 19 through 20. will result in the destruction of idols and civil war and failure in council and government. This day of visitation will be one of physical catastrophe to the waters of the Nile will fail. And consequently, all industry, fishing, weaving, building will be paralyzed. Yet the prophet saw hope, even for Egypt. A triple alliance of Israel, Egypt, and Assyria will be made a blessing in the midst of the earth. Turning again to Babylon in 21:1-10, he described the whirlwind sweeping against it. So terrible was the sight that he was filled with horror. And the burdens of Edom and Arabia in 21:11-17. Again, peoples that have touched his people, whether good or bad. The prophet had heard some inquiring voice demanding the hour of the night. In few words, he answered that he saw morning and night and invited further inquiry. The vision announces the coming of judgment within a year upon the children of Kedar. The picture there is of a watchman watching through the night. And what that watchman saw was that within a year, there would judgment would come upon the children of Kedar. The indifference of Jerusalem, chapter 22, a prophecy of spiritual indifference. Mourning was called for, but they were full of merriment. This was an unpardonable sin as it revealed their callousness of their heart. Following this is a protest about Shibna. His denunciation of Shibna, declaring his rejection from his office, and in his place he will be replaced by Eliakim. The burden of Tyre, God gets down to peoples in government as well in these prophecies. The burden of Tyre, just north of Israel, verse 20, chapter 23, a graphic description of her desolation. Her harbors are closed, her harbors are desolate. After 70 years, he declared that she should be back to a position of affluence. Her restoration was to be in some way of service to God's own people. No hint of Tyre turning to God is in the prophecy. Then we have the burden of the world, chapters 24 through 27. Is in the last chapters of the second circle. The world is seen under the government of the throne of God. And it's good to go back and remind ourselves that the world is under the government of the throne of God. The consequences of widespread corruption, widespread desolation is determined upon. A worldwide judgment ends with the declaration that it will be by the act of Jehovah. Next, a song of praise for judgment, both in its procedure and in its results. His illumination of the nations followed by the ending of sorrow and the wiping away of tears. The deep secret of the new condition will be that of the mind that is stayed on the Lord. The prophet utters the final call to the people of God. This circle ends with a message which describes the process towards certain restoration. This he referred under the figure of the vineyard, the opposite picture of chapter 5, where we saw the perfect vineyard, but it brought forth stinky, sour grapes. This is the opposite picture here. The third and last circle, 28 through 35, consists of a series of prophecies concerning the chosen and the world. The chosen, 28 through 33, opens with a revelation of the difficulties Isaiah had to contend and his unswerving loyalty to the truth. No matter how hard it was, he remained loyal to the truth. Not so much the church in America today. When it gets tough in America, the tough start compromising. And let not be us. In answer to his declaration that judgment was to fall upon Ephraim, priests and prophets overcome by strong drink taunted him with his purposeful halting method. His method in chapter 28 is something for you to behold, and his method is a method that I often use. He gathers a little from here and a little from there, line upon line, precept upon precept, and he puts together his message in that way. A series of passionate messages follows this picture. The first sets forth the purpose of Jehovah in judgment, denouncing an alliance with Egypt, declaring the shame of it and its uselessness. A second time he denounces the alliance with Egypt, a false trust, a turning of their back upon their Lord. The prophet then described the beneficent reign of the coming king. He made a second appeal to the women. A degraded womanhood always creates a dissipated and weakened manhood. Interesting, huh? Nothing new there under the sun, huh? After this, the prophet celebrated a victory and predicted the method of the final trumpet. The presence of God is a fire filling the heart of the sinner with fear. So the method of the final trumpet triumph, the presence of God is a fire filling the heart of the sinner with fear. Did not our hearts burn when he spoke his word unto us? And that should issue in good, godly fear. The world, 34 through 35, he saw in the future worldwide desolation. From this, he passed to a description of the judgment of God upon Edom. The final words stands in startling contrast. Following the picture of desolation, we have one of restoration towards peace. Then we have our second major chunk, if you will. Historical interlude involving King Hezekiah, 36 through 39. Hezekiah's trouble, chapter 36. The first was that of Sennacherib's invasion up to the neighborhood of Jerusalem. Rabshakeh was sent as an ambassador of Sennacherib, taunting the rulers of Jerusalem. Full of fear, they requested him to speak in Aramaic that the Jews might not understand. He responded by addressing himself directly to the people in Hebrew. And he said basically this: do not trust in Jehovah and your king. Then we have Hezekiah's prayer following this threat and the fear of the people. In this hour of trial, Isaiah returned messages of hope to Hezekiah. Rabshakeh returned with a blasphemous letter to Hezekiah. Hezekiah spread it out before the Lord, and Isaiah responded with a message declaring the coming judgment of God upon Sennacherib on account of his sin of blasphemy. By the direct act of Jehovah, the Assyrian army was destroyed by one angel, 185,000 soldiers. Sennacherib returning to Nineveh and turned to Nineveh and was slain by his own sons. This was also in the prophecy. Then we have Hezekiah's sickness in chapter 38. We next have an account of his sickness and of his prayer that his life might be spared. The answer was plus 15 years. A psalm of Hezekiah makes it evident that he recognized his afflictions as well as his deliverance, because he was very sick. Hezekiah's folly, chapter 39. Flattered by the letters and presents sent to him from the king of Babylon, which was a nothing kingdom at this time, or very small, he exposed all his wealth to the messengers. Isaiah visited him, understanding the motives of the king of Babylon, predicting that Babylon would carry away all the things which the spies had seen, and that they did. Prophecies of peace, 40 through 66. The prophecies of peace move in three circles. So following judgment, following historical interlude, we have prophecies of peace. The purpose of peace, the prince of peace, the program of peace. The purpose of peace, 40 through 48. The prologue in Isaiah 40, 1 through 11. The purpose of peace is introduced by a prologue. Comfort you, my people. The prophet is commissioned to announce the advent of Jehovah God. The majesty of Jehovah celebrated in 40, 12 through 31. First, in essentials of might and of wisdom and of government. Second, by the impossibility of comparison. There is no comparison to him. Third, by the evidences and creation of the established government of the earth and of the heavens. Fourth, by Jehovah's grace, which supplies the need of those who lack. The great manifesto of Jehovah comes next in order, chapters 41 and 42. It declares the divine choice of Cyrus as a servant of God, named 100 years before he was born. Jehovah challenges all peoples as to the fact that he has made known beforehand things to come. Israel is also addressed as the chosen servant of God, and his purpose for them is peace. The people are seen as unable on their own to fulfill the divine purpose of peace. You can't work for peace. You must receive it and experience it from the Lord. His highest purposes for them, therefore, are to be realized in and through one man. It is evident that the prophet was looking far beyond Cyrus to another. The description of the servant of Jehovah is full of stately beauty. The servant of God was to be called and given by Jehovah for the glory of his name. The prophet appealed to the people to hear, look, and understand the meaning of the divine method. Following the manifesto, we have certain messages of Jehovah in chapters 43 through 45. He created, formed, called his people for his glory. The next declares his present purpose of deliverance and his intention to destroy their foes. An appeal to the people is made, promising the outpouring of spirit and blessing upon Israel. He then compares himself with idols, claiming to be the first and the last, describing with fine scorn the vanity of idol makers and the unprofitableness of their idols. In startling contrast, he speaks of his own might versus their zero might. Next in order, we have his charge to Cyrus, consisting of the making of a promise, a purpose, the claiming of power, and a protest against any objections. He then announces his purpose for Israel, that all the people shall submit to them. That will happen in the kingdom age. Finally, he declares his purpose for the ends of the earth, calling the nations to compare him with idols, then to submit to him in order to find salvation. The fall of Babylon is the subject of the next message, chapters 46 through 47, delivered to the house of Jacob, and first declares that the fall of Babylon is determined. Idols are seen bowing down to the Lord, while men have to carry them to a supposedly safe place. Yet he has carried his people and will continue to do so. You get the picture of, oh, there's trouble. We have to protect our idols. Wait a minute. Who's worshiping who here? Okay. The final appeal, chapter 48. His method is that of the prophecy and performance. An illustration of the method is that of the calling of Cyrus. He finally declares again that his purpose is their peace and redemption, but no peace for the wicked. No peace for the wicked. And we have the Prince of Peace in 49 through 57. In a series of messages, we see him first sustained through suffering. Sustained through suffering. 49 through 53. The servant is himself the speaker, and he tells the story of his call by Jehovah. The despised and exalted one is yet to be the messenger of deliverance to the oppressed people. Jehovah declares the reason of all their suffering to be their own sin. It is evident Jehovah is calling his servant to a triumph which can only be won through suffering. The servant yields himself to the smiters and all the suffering and shame. An appeal is made to those who sit in darkness to now trust the Lord. Messages follow to such as are afflicted, which tell of the coming end of suffering and the beginning of strength as a result of the return of Jehovah. The completion of the suffering of the servant, it is a pathway of rejection, of vicarious suffering, of atoning death. The servant of God is seen as he passes through pain, through to triumph, through humbling to exaltation. Then there's singing in triumph in 54 through 57. First, there's the song of assurance, which tells of restoration and the end of all forsaking. Restoration is described in its material magnificence, its moral correctness. Immediately following the song is a message containing a great appeal. The thirsty and dissatisfied are called back to Jehovah to enter into the peace and prosperity. In view of the promise of near salvation, the man is pronounced blessed who submits himself. Evil is to be judged. The judgment must first fall upon corrupt spiritual leaders and the apostate people. Judgment is, however, as always, in the economy of Jehovah, to be discriminative. The high and lofty one will dwell in fellowship with such as are of a contrite and a humble spirit. In the midst of his judgment, he always discriminates and doesn't say, oops, I didn't mean to judge Bob. Oh, I made a mistake. He is one of mine. Oi! Never. He's very discriminating in his judgments. The program of peace, 58 through 66. Lastly, the program of peace declares its conditions. The people complain that there has been no response on the part of God when they fast. The reason for this silence is that the fasting has been formal and not sincere. He then describes true spirituality and declares what are its rewards. The prophet next describes the ultimate realization of peace in 60 through 62. First, as to its material prosperity, the exiles are seen returning from far and near. At last, there comes a day of perfect government, perfect glory, perfect gladness. Beneath the material realization, there is a spiritual realization by the anointed messenger, through whose work the people are restored to their true place in the economy of God. Old names, forsaken and desolate, are changed for new ones. Hephzibah, delight, and Beulah, married. Old names are exchanged for good new names. The last messages reaffirm the divine principle of discrimination and judgment in 63 through 66. Victories can only be won through processes of judgment. He saw the warrior returning, stained with the conflict, marching in the might and majesty of victory. He then described the sifting of the people. The rebellious are doomed. The servants of the Most High are led into the realization of his peace. The great prophecy closes with the reaffirmation of the coming of Jehovah as a whirlwind, pleading by fire with men and to bring in the new heavens and the new earth. So you are to focus on the rest of page 8, all of page 9, and half of page 10. And that brings us to Jeremiah, the weeping prophet. And all the material and the focusing is from Chuck Missler, from his notes, most of which you don't have in your book. So you have your book, you have these notes, so you're going to get much more than just reading the book. Jeremiah, the weeping prophet. Morgan says this: Jeremiah was the Lord's spokesman in days of darkness and disaster. Okay? That sounds like our days. Are we to be his spokesman? Yes, we are. In great suffering, he delivered his messages of punishment and of promise with unswerving loyalty. Nevertheless, the people refused to hear or to obey. Wow, what a trifecta to have to experience and to be. Delivered his messages. He was loyal. Messages of punishment and promise. Nevertheless, the people refused to hear. He was the son of Hilkiah of a priestly family. His ministry extended 40 years from the 13th year of Josiah to the 11th of Zedekiah. We wrong Jeremiah when we speak of him merely as the prophet of tears and fears. His tears never made him unfaithful to the divine message. You get that? That's important. His tears never made him unfaithful. All evidences of weakness were manifested only in the presence of his God, not before the people. Interesting. But never when he stood up as God's messenger. The book falls into two parts: the prophet's call and commission, 1 through 13, the prophet's ministry, 14 through 51. There's an historical appendix in chapter 53. The prophet's call and commission in 1 through 13. The first part gives us the story of his call and commission. It may be that the messages in the first part were delivered as they were received. It is evident that he was being prepared for that sorrowful, heavy ministry which was to follow. The first three verses constitute a title page naming the author, the dates of his ministry. The personal call in 1:4 through 19. Over against the eye of Jeremiah's fear, Jehovah set the eye of his omnipotence. My power will be greater than your fear. The call was then official and was ratified by the two signs of the almond tree and the seething cauldron. Those were the two witnesses that Jeremiah got to confirm the fact that he was called to this ministry he did not want to do. The commission, chapters 2 through 13. The commissioning of Jeremiah for ministry is marked by three distinct movements. Each ends with the account of how Jehovah strengthened his servant. The first movement is a command to utter an impeachment of Israel, chapters 2 through 6. She was charged with forsaking Jehovah with obstinate sinfulness. The impeachment ended with a summary describing Israel's infidelity and its issue. What comes of that? The prophet then appealed to the people to return under specific conditions. Suddenly, the prophet turned to the subject of judgment, 4:3 through 6:26. He declared that it was determined, described it, and affirmed its inevitableness. The reason of judgment as being their utter corruption of conduct. They're not a church, by the way. Their unbelief of the prophetic message and their revolting and rebellious heart. He foretold the taking of the city and the suffering of the people. The first movement ends with the words of Jehovah to Jeremiah to strengthen him. How cool is that? Heavy message ends with being strengthened afterwards. The second movement of the prophet details first the sins of worship, 7 through 9. At the temple gate, the prophet rebuked the people for trusting in external rituals. So terrible was the condition that he was charged at last not to pray for them. The Lord told him, do not pray for these people. For this idolatry of formalism. The idolatry of formalism. Think about that. Going through the rituals can be an idolatry. The sentence of judgment was again pronounced. The prophet pours out his soul in lamentation and is strengthened. Notice what he doesn't do. He doesn't get bitter with the people. Instead, he's brokenhearted about the people. To this cry of his servant, Jehovah replied in a fivefold declaration. Because of their sin, the reason of judgment was that of their persistent rebellion. He proclaimed the true ground of glory to be their understanding and knowledge of Jehovah. In the third movement, the sin of idolatry in chapters 10 through 13. On the sin of idolatry, he pronounced judgment. He proclaimed in the cities of Judah and Jerusalem, the sin of the fathers was being repeated by them. It ends with Jehovah again strengthens him and gives two affirming signs to him. The prophet's ministry, 14 through 51, the bulk of his ministry, it falls into three sections. Prophecies before the fall of Jerusalem, 14 through 39. Prophecies after the fall. Prophecies concerning the nations. Here again, another prophet who not only prophesies of the Jewish people, but of the nations as well. Prophecies before the fall of Jerusalem, 14 through 39, opens with God's determination to punish. It is introduced by a graphic parable of drought in which the high and the low are affected alike. Then follows the account of a remarkable controversy between Jeremiah and Jehovah. The prophet appealed to Jehovah repeatedly on behalf of the people. Jehovah replied by forbidding him to pray for them. He is determined to punish them. Jeremiah cries out in anguish. The Lord promises to strengthen him for the delivery of his message. Okay? The strength doesn't come in the reception of the message, but from the one who told him to deliver it. That's a key thing for us to remember. You are to be faithful to deliver the message. And if you're going to get your strength from their response, you're going to be let down. You just have to be faithful. The response of it is God's business with that person or persons. He was then called, next page, to a life of personal asceticism, to abstain both from mourning and from mirth. He was to stand aloof from the people in order to deliver to them the messages of God. He declares by two pictures the contrast of those who trust in men and those who trust in Jehovah. He was then commissioned to stand in the gate of the people. He offered them the test of the Sabbath, warning them of how their fathers failed in this respect. He declared to them that if they refused to hearken regarding the Sabbath, this one time, the judgment must fall. Guess what they did? They did not hearken. Wow. Did not keep it. The second series of messages consists of the declarations of God's absolute supremacy, 18 through 20. Jeremiah was sent to the house of the potter. Power was manifest in the potter's manipulation of the clay and pity in his remaking of the marred vessel. The explanation was given by Jehovah himself. The house of Israel was as clay in his hands, but his will must and will be accomplished. He then went into the valley of Hinnom with a potter's vessel with a message of judgment. This action stirred up yet fiercer persecution against him. He was arrested and persecuted in prison. Out of the midst of these circumstances, he poured out his soul in the presence of Jehovah. He always did this in private, just so you know. Okay, he declared that he would not speak the word, but it had become a burning fire inside of him. And I am not going to talk anymore. And his temperature kept rising and rising and rising and rising. The only way to make the temperature go down is to do what? To speak. He would not refrain. He could not refrain from speaking forth his word. God, please give us that kind of fire and drive. The final messages before the fall of Jerusalem were delivered to Zedekiah, the last king, 21 through 27. Nebuchadnezzar was approaching. Zedekiah sent to inquire whether he might hope for the interference and deliverance of Jehovah. Now you call ask. Jeremiah told him of the disaster that was imminent in great detail, did not give him any hope. He was commanded to go to the house of the king and not speak through messengers. Arrived at the court, he repeated his call to repentance and his warning. Then reviewed the history of his three predecessors, Jehoahaz, a.k.a. Shalom, Jehoiakim, and Jehoiachin, a.k.a. Coniah. The king was always to be a shepherd, but the men in office had destroyed and scattered the sheep. He turned to the prophets, went from the king to the prophets, and spoke of them out of a broken heart. Their judgment was consequent upon the falseness of the messages they had delivered. False kings, false prophets had led the people into courses of evil. The people, though, had willingly listened and followed. They desired it so. It's pretty heavy. Between Hananiah and Jeremiah, the conflict with the false prophets clearly was manifest in 28 through 29. It is evident that the exiles were disturbed by the false prophesying. Jeremiah, in a letter, warned them to beware of false prophets and to get settled in Babylon. Then occurs a series of prophecies whose dominant note is that of hope in 30 through 33. Uttered while in prison, in darkness, Jeremiah was granted visions of ultimate restoration. What a great place to get a message like that, huh? The first of these of the people of God overwhelmed with sorrow will pass through trouble to triumph. In graphic language, the prophet described the time of Jacob's trouble, the tribulation, and predicted deliverance. The song then merges into a description of the issues of restoration. The city rebuilt, the people gathered back to it so that sorrow passes away. In that day, a new covenant will be made between Jehovah and his people, internal and spiritual. The next prophecy of hope. the charge given to him to purchase the field in Anatoth. This command he obeyed. He inquired of Jehovah as to why he was purchasing a field when the land was wholly given over to judgment. Jehovah announced the certainty of the judgment, but also declared the certainty of ultimate restoration. The purchase of the field was intended as a sign of the ultimate repossession of the land, therefore the land he purchased. The three prophecies delivered while Nebuchadnezzar besieged the city, 34 through 35. The first foretold the success of Nebuchadnezzar and described the manner of Zedekiah's death. The second is a denunciation of Zedekiah for having broken his covenant with the Hebrew servants. In the third, Jeremiah told the story of how the Rechabites, who were true to their vow to not drink. The telling of the story was that the prophet might put in contrast with it the sin of Judah, who never kept their word. Next, Jeremiah's prophecies against Judah were committed to writing, chapter 36. He obeyed by dictating to Barak, who eventually read them to the people and princes. Finally, they were read by Jehudi to the king, who in anger destroyed the roll. But you could never destroy the living word. The final movement of this section is history of the siege before the fall of Jerusalem, 37 through 39. Jeremiah is first seen as free. The army of Pharaoh comes forth, and the king hoped that it might aid him against Nebuchadnezzar. Jeremiah declared that there was no hope in that quarter. He left, was arrested as a traitor. Through the intervention of Ebed-Melech, he was released from there. Perplexed, Zedekiah again sent for Jeremiah, insisted the city should be taken by the Chaldeans. He therefore advised Zedekiah to surrender and so save the city from burning and himself from death. The section ends with the story of the fall of Jerusalem, which the prophet had so long foretold. Nebuchadnezzar enters. Zedekiah fled. He was overtaken, and his sons were slain before his eyes. Then his own eyes were put out. He was bound and carried to Babylon. But Jeremiah was protected. Fall of Jerusalem, 40 through 45. The first movement begins with Jeremiah's protest against going into Egypt. Released, Jeremiah joined the remnant, remaining in the land under the governorship of Gedaliah, urging the people to avail themselves of the privilege granted to them to settle in the land. But the governor was warned by Johanan of the plot formed against his life by Ishmael. Ishmael, through treachery, slayed Gedaliah and others, leading captives away to the children of Ammon. Before going to Egypt, they sought counsel from Jeremiah, asking him to inquire of Jehovah, promising to really be obedient this time, like we weren't in the past, right? He told them clearly the will of God was that they should not go to Egypt. So what did they do? He warned them that if he went into Egypt, the judgment of God would follow upon them, actually. His word was not obeyed. They charged him with speaking falsely in rebellion and passed over into Egypt. Jeremiah accompanied them. His next messages were delivered there. The second movement chronicles the prophecies in Egypt. How many of you knew that Jeremiah prophesied while in Egypt? Interesting. The first prophecy spoke of the coming victory of Babylon over Egypt. Then a fiery protest against the persistent rebellion of the people of God. This remnant would be cut off. They deliberately declared their intention to continue their idolatrous practices. He ended by declaring that the sign of Jehovah to them would be the defeat of Pharaoh Hophra. The messages of Jeremiah to Barak, chapter 45. He was charged not to seek great things for himself, promised that his own life would be preserved if he did not seek great things for himself. Guess what he did? Saw great things for himself. Prophecies concerning the nations, 46 through 51. The first of these has to do with Egypt, and imagine that, and consists of two prophecies. The prophet predicted the doom of Egypt. He foretold the defeat of Egypt by Nebuchadnezzar. Then a message of comfort to Jacob, who is not to be utterly destroyed, but corrected by judgment. The word concerning the Philistines of chapter 47 was a foretelling of a coming scourge against them from the north. The word of the Lord concerning Moab, chapter 48, was one of judgment. It's nevertheless closed with a gleam of hope, affliction, and helplessness graphically set forth. A punishment for Moab for the sin of magnifying himself against the Lord. He announced the promise of Jehovah that finally he would restore the captivity of Moab. Concerning Ammon, the captivity of the children of Ammon prophesied, but his message ends with a gleam of hope. Concerning Edom, destruction was foretold in spite of her wisdom, declaring that notwithstanding their arrogancy and security, Jehovah would bring them down. Damascus was described in her decay in chapter 49. It does not seem that in Jeremiah's time there was an intimate relationship with her in Israel. He saw that she was within the divine government and that judgment was determined against her. Concerning Kedar and Hazor, also in 49, represent the Arab peoples, those who dwelt at settled centers, yet not in walled cities. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, was to be the instrument of judgment. Prophecy against Elam, also in 49. Of Elam, nothing could be said with certainty. One was one of judgment, ending once more with a gleam of hope, though she is under divine displeasure. Last, concerning Babylon, she was seen as the instrument of God's judgment, finally on account of her own sin and corruption. That judgment must inevitably fall upon her. What he said concerning Babylon had a direct bearing upon the people of God. The prophecy falls into two parts, the first foretelling Babylon's doom and Israel's delivery. So I'll let you finish reading. The prophecy falls into two parts. The last chapter on page 15, consists of an historical appendix, and I'll let you read that. Your focus from Chuck Missler is on the rest of page 15 and on to 16, and then we have the Lamentations of Jeremiah. In the Septuagint, the Lamentations are prefaced with these words, "And it came to pass that after Israel had been carried away captive and Jerusalem made desolate, Jeremiah sat weeping and lamented this lament over Jerusalem and said." This serves to show that long before the coming of Christ, the Lamentations were considered by Jewish scholars to be the work of Jeremiah. The paradox that is Jeremiah. Jeremiah is a man having a keen sense of the righteousness of judgment because of sin. On the one hand, he's very sensitive, a keen sense of righteousness because of judgment because of sin. Yet he was overwhelmed with sorrow for his people. That is a great combination to have in terms of characteristics in ministry. There is no exultation over the fulfillment of his predictions. He didn't go around saying, "See, I told you so. Boy, am I happy camper. What I said came true." None of that from him. Twofold loyalty is manifest. First, to God in confession of sin, and to his people in their sorrow. The chapter division of the book is the natural one. It consists of five poems, the title of which may be written as we have them here. So you can go through as part of your homework, read through each of the five chapters. There are five poems, if you will, and that'll bring us to the book of Ezekiel on page 17. Ezekiel, the prophet, of the prophet Ezekiel, personally, we only know that he was a priest and the son of Buzi. The 30th year probably refers to his age, and he was a priest. 30 was the age at which they commenced their priesthood work. Concurrent with Jeremiah, this would account for influence of Jeremiah upon Ezekiel. His method was that of symbolism, okay? So Jeremiah had an awful lot of messages that he gave. He did some quirky things, but Ezekiel's ministry is quirky. Let's put it that way. How he did send his messages. It is full of visions, symbolic actions, similitudes, parables, proverbs, allegories, and prophecies. He looked through the existing devastation to ultimate deliverance, recognizing the righteous reprobation, yet he foretold a glorious restoration, based his conviction on the unlying character of God. His prophesying was to comfort the exiles and to preserve them from the idolatry surrounding them. God is going to cure them of idolatry one way or another, yet he still had to warn them about the idolatry that surrounded them. When they came back, idolatry wasn't a problem. Love was a problem. And formalism was a problem, but not idolatry. This book may be divided thus. Chapters 1 through 3, the prophet's preparation. Preparation. Notice all the preparation that these prophets are getting. We too are to be prepared. Chapters 4 through 24, reprobation, the judgment. Chapters 25 through 48, restoration. What was Isaiah's? Judgment followed by peace. Okay? A similar flow here. Chapters 1 through 3, the prophet's preparation. The second and third verses, which are really parenthetical, may be treated as a title page. This gives the date, states the fact that the word came expressly to him. The division dealing with the prophet's preparation falls into two sections. The first describing the visions he saw, and the second, the voices that he heard. So he received the word of the Lord through what? Through vision, seeing. Remember, seer is one who sees. And then through voices, the still, small voice that he heard of God. The visions were inclusive of visions of God. They proceeded in four manifestations. The first was a cloud swept into sight by a stormy wind, continually flashing forth in glory. The second was the appearance of four living ones who moved in rhythmic unity. The third appearance was that of wheels which rotated in harmony with each other. The fourth, the appearance of a firmament embracing the ceaseless activity of the living ones. Above the firmament, a voice was heard, and then the likeness of a throne was seen. Finally, a person was manifested of the nature of fire, surrounded by a glory like that of a rainbow. In the presence of the manifested glory, Ezekiel fell upon his face and then heard the voice. This voice called him to listen and then to deliver the message of God to Israel, charging him to speak it whether they would hear it or not. Again, your responsibility is to be faithful and to speak it. The results are not yours. Okay? Ratified by the symbolism of a roll handed to him, which he ate, and in his mouth was as honey. It was sweet to him. The voice charged him to be loyal to the word of the Lord. Borne up by the Spirit into the midst of the captives, he sat astonished for 7 days. I would too, after all that. The word of Jehovah came to him again. He was reminded of the source of the message. Then we have the section on reprobation. The second division contains the messages of the prophet concerning the reprobation of the chosen nation. These fall into three parts. First, he described the results of reprobation, of judgment. Second, he declared the reasons for their reprobation. Third, he proclaimed the righteousness of reprobation. Okay, and so you can read through the reprobation and those three subsets, and that'll be a part of your reading assignment. And then that continues on page 19. And there were a lot of strange things that he did. On page 20, we have he proclaimed the righteousness of reprobation in 20 through 24. And the vindication of that before the elders. Then we turn to page 21. We have restoration, 25 through 48. The last division deals with the subject of the ultimate restoration of the chosen nation. It falls into three sections. The first part of restoration has to do with the nations themselves. The second part of the restoration with the nation. The third part of restoration describes a restored order. The restored order. The first part of restoration has to do with the nations. I'll let you read that, and let's go to the second part of the restoration with the nation, 33 through 39, and that would be on page 22 towards the bottom. The second part of the restoration with the nation. Ezekiel next delivered a series of messages concerning the chosen nation. The first described the watchmen. The second dealt with shepherds, false and true. And to an extent that we're all to be watchmen, and we have responsibility over those under us, whether they be lambs or adult sheep as well. The shepherds, the third set forth the new order. The fourth consisted of a vision of the Valley of Bones, chapter 37. The fifth dealt with the last enemy. The first message described the watchman, describes the function and responsibilities of the prophet under the figure of a watchman. The duty of the watchman was to give warning of the approach of a foe. He was to declare to the people in their sins that Jehovah had no pleasure in the death of the wicked. Past acts of righteousness will not atone for present transgression. Past acts of righteousness will not atone for present transgression. Past sin would be pardoned if the sinner turned to Jehovah. The second message dealt with shepherds, false and true, chapter 34. Its first movement was an indictment of the false shepherds. They had cared for themselves and neglected the flock. Therefore, the flock was scattered and devoured. This indictment was followed by a description full of beauty of Jehovah's method of deliverance. He himself would come to search for his sheep and be their righteous government. The Lord is my shepherd. Third message set forth the new order, 35 to 36, by contrasting Mount Seir, Edom, with the mountains of Israel. The sin of Mount Seir had been that of perpetual enmity. It would be a perpetual desolation. Remember, it says in Malachi, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. Edom, Esau, was in perpetual enmity with Israel. The mountains of Israel would be delivered from their enemies and become abundantly fruitful. A description of the method of restoration followed. The people were to be gathered from all countries, cleansed from filthiness, and spiritually remade. What a great picture that is. The fourth message consisted of a vision of the Valley of Bones. Over these bones, he was commanded to prophesy. He beheld the bones coming together and being clothed with sinews and flesh. He was commanded to prophesy to the wind, the ruach, the spirit, saw the corpses stand up upon their feet, a living army. Next, he was commanded to join two sticks into one and to declare to the people that God would gather the scattered ones from among the nations, making them one under the dominion of a new king within the terms of a new covenant. The fifth message dealt with the last enemy, talking about Gog and Magog, and I'll let you read the rest of that as well as the rest of the Ezekiel notes from page 23 to the middle of 24. And then you have focusing from Missler on Ezekiel. He has a lot of great stuff there that we didn't cover in our notes. And that goes from 24, 25, 26 to the top of page 27, which brings us to the book of Daniel. Daniel, the prophet of interpretation. Wow. The gift of interpretation, as well as he received some visions. Daniel, the prophet of interpretation. Daniel was carried away in captivity before Ezekiel with Nebuchadnezzar's first invasion. His whole life from that time would seem to have been spent in Babylon. His personal history as a captive is a remarkable one. He rose to positions of power in three kingdoms: Babylon with three kings, the Medes and the Persians. But he did not compromise. Unswerving loyalty to the God of his father. Another one who did not compromise. Okay? Boy, if we get nothing tonight, that we get the fact of the uncompromising of God's servants and his and their loyalty to God and God's preserving of them. His prophecies deal far more fully with Gentile nations than the Hebrew people, except 9:24 through 27. His ministry was exercised largely through visions and their interpretation. The first half of the book is occupied with historic matter, giving us pictures of the times and conditions in which he lived. The second half of the book deals with visions and interpretations, thus constituting the bulk of his prophetic message. The book falls thus into two divisions. Chapters 1 through 6, the historic night. Chapters 7 through 12, the prophetic light. The historic nights, night during the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, chapters 1 through 4, the reign of Belshazzar, his grandson, chapter 5, the reign of Darius, who was a Mede, Medo-Persian, in chapter 6. During the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, 1 through 4, Daniel's history. Daniel became into favor and power. Some of the choices of Judah's young men were included among the king's own confidential servants. Among those selected were four specially named, and among the four, Daniel. Their training lasted for 3 years and included special physical attention. Food and drink being supplied from the king's table was diplomatic and in wisdom refused. Daniel manifested his strength of spiritual character and loyalty to God. He purposed to be undefiled by abstaining from the king's meat and wine, which were offered to idols. In wisdom, he asked for a 10-day test. The test vindicated his purpose, and Daniel and his friends were allowed to proceed with their training, not eating the king's meat and drinking his wine. Presented to Nebuchadnezzar and approved by him, they were appointed to positions in the kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar then in chapter 2 had a what? He had a dream. Nebuchadnezzar, troubled by dreams, called together his magicians to reveal and interpret the dream. He's a smart guy, okay? Because you can tell a dream and come up with any kind of interpretation. But to tell the dream and the interpretation, whoa. He demanded they should tell him the dream and interpret it. And he had an incredible promotional system. If they didn't do it, he would make their homes a dunghill and kill all of their family and them. But if they did, they would get promoted. Wow, what a promotional method he had. Being unable to do so, he was furious and commanded their destruction, including the young Hebrews. Daniel asked for time from the king and promised to show the dream and its interpretation. Thus being granted, they sought the Lord in prayer. The secrets were revealed to Daniel in a vision. He stood before the king, ascribing to God the glory of the interpretation he was about to give. He then vividly described the image of the king's dream and interpreted its meaning, showing the successive kingdoms of Babylon, the Medes and Persia, Greece, Rome, the 10 kingdoms, and the final setting up of the kingdom of heaven. Through metallurgy, he showed that there would be a process of deterioration from gold to silver to iron, etc., to brass to iron. The mind of Nebuchadnezzar, being convinced, at once recognized the supremacy of God, rewarding Daniel. He set him over the province and the wise men, the Magi. Nebuchadnezzar's pride, chapter 3. The pride of Nebuchadnezzar set up a great image of gold in the plain of Dura. The head of gold in the image of Nebuchadnezzar's dream symbolized Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar's image, though, was all gold, revealing his vision of the power and the perpetuity of Babylon. He commanded all peoples to bow down and worship, but the Hebrew three refused to bow to the image. With great heroism, they trusted in God and were delivered from the fiery furnace. This deliverance deeply impressed Nebuchadnezzar. I'd be deeply impressed. He sanctioned their God and promoted them. He sanctioned their God and promoted them. Nebuchadnezzar's manifesto, chapter 4. I think we'll see him in heaven. Nebuchadnezzar's manifesto sets forth the dealings of the Most High God with him personally. It opens in praise and then proceeds to tell the story of his own humbling before God. The quickest way up is down. And ends with a description of his restoration and a final ascription of praise. In the midst of his prosperity, he had a dream which filled him again with fear. His magi were unable to interpret it for him. He sent for Daniel and described his vision to him, evidently because he saw the application of the dream to the king. Daniel was astonished, but he nevertheless, in loyalty to truth, interpreted to him its meaning. By the decree of the Most High, he would be driven out a madman from men for a long time, 7 years. Daniel appealed to him to turn from sin, but a year later, the dream was fulfilled. See how God gives room for what? Repentance. In the midst of a proud boast, he was stricken with madness. Finally restored to reason, he recognized the God of heaven and was restored to his kingdom. He uttered the praise of the Most High. The reign of Belshazzar happens to be his, Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. In chapter 5, we had the big party, the carousal, the writing on the wall. Daniel reappears, the fulfillment. At the end of chapter 5, the carousal. He had succeeded to the throne of his grandfather at a great party. There appeared to him a mystic hand. Unbeknownst to him, the hand was writing on the wall his doom and that of his kingdom. Again, the wise men were unable to interpret the meaning of the words that the hand wrote on the wall. Daniel, here comes Daniel. Daniel, who was not in with or known by the king, was sent for. The attitude of Daniel before him was full of dignity and loyalty to God. He first declined all the king's gifts and then charged him with his guilt. He proclaimed God as seated high over the thrones of earth. Let us not forget that. He interpreted the writing as indicating God's determination to end his kingdom. And finally, the future of Babylon as divided among Medes and Persians. The fulfillment in 5:30-31, with dramatic and terrible force, the story concludes this way. In that night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom. The reign of Darius, chapter 6, the appointment of Daniel, the plot against Daniel, the deliverance of Daniel, the proclamation. The appointment of Daniel, 6:1-3, Darius appointed Daniel as one of three presidents and proposed to set him over the whole realm. The plot, chapter 6, 4-15, this stirred up jealousy in the hearts of the other presidents and rulers, who with great cunning they planned his downfall, unable to find anything against him except in the matter of his relationship to his God. They induced the king to sign a decree that would necessarily involve the downfall of Daniel. His loyalty, though, never wavered. He continued to observe the acts of worship which had been his custom. The deliverance in 6:6-16, against the desire of the king, he was cast into the den of lions and was supernaturally delivered. The proclamation in 6:25-28, a proclamation made by Darius, and Daniel prospered through his reign and in the reign of Cyrus, the same Cyrus we read about in Isaiah. Chapter 7-12, our next subsection, the prophetic light. Belshazzar's reign, in Darius's reign, and in Cyrus's reign. Belshazzar's reign, 7-8, Daniel's first vision in the first year, chapter 7. Daniel's second vision in the third year, chapter 8. Daniel's first vision in the first year, the vision, 7:1-14. During the reign of Belshazzar, two visions were granted to Daniel. The first of these was of four beasts arising from the sea. So the dream of Nebuchadnezzar we saw this beautiful statue of these various metals. That's man's point of view. Now you're getting God's point of view of the same four. And what does God see them as? Beasts. Beasts arising from the sea. The last of which had 10 horns. There arose another horn among them, which destroyed them. The vision then became of thrones and the appearing of the glory of one who overcame the beast. The explanation in 7:15-28, these visions troubled Daniel, but an interpretation was given to him. The beast symbolized four kings. From the final vision, the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom forever. The meaning of the fourth beast and the horns was vouchsafed to him, which is the government of Jehovah, the final establishment of his kingdom over all others. Daniel's second vision in the third year, 8:1-14. 2 years later, another vision came to him. It was that of a ram with two horns pushing westward, northward, and southward. A he-goat attacked the ram and overcame him and magnified himself. Four horns appeared. One out of one came another horn, which grew until it had broken down the sanctuary. The explanation of this vision goes on in chapter 8. Again, he sought to understand it, and interpretation was granted to him. The two-horned ram represented the united power of the Medes and Persia. The rough he-goat was the king of Greece, Alexander the Great. The effects of the vision upon Daniel was such that he was faint and sick. Being restored, he continued to fulfill his office in the kingdom until the hour he interpreted the writing to Belshazzar and Darius succeeded to the throne. That gives you the timing of that. Darius's reign, chapter 9, Daniel and the prophecy of Jeremiah, Daniel's confession and prayer, the coming of Gabriel, the revelation, chapter 9, 24-27. Daniel and the prophecy of Jeremiah, 9:1-2. Daniel and Darius' first year, conscious that Jeremiah's 70 years were coming to a close, prayed. And I believe that Daniel thought that the kingdom was going to be established on the earth. The visions that he saw of ultimately the coming kingdom would be established. The Messiah would come and set it up. Daniel's confession and prayer. He prayed for personal corporate penitence, pleading their cause. He sought the Lord that the reproaches of Jerusalem might be put away. The coming of Gabriel. In the midst of this intercession, Gabriel came to him, declaring that he was greatly beloved, urging him to understand the vision. He then made a revelation to him concerning the divine program. The revelation itself, 77s of weeks were decreed upon the people and the city. They were divided into three periods. The first, 7 sevens. The second, 62 weeks or sevens. The third, 1 seven, which would give you a total of how many sevens? 70. How many years would that be? That would be 490 years. So, and in your focusing, Missler will go into that in great detail for you. Probably the four most important prophetic verses in the Old Testament that you need to get a grasp of. Cyrus's reign, 10-12, the introductory apocalypse, the prophetic history, the last things foretold, chapter 12, 1-3, the closing of the book, 12:4-13. The introductory apocalypse, verse 10, the last things were revealed to Daniel in the reign of Cyrus. In the third year of Cyrus, this is after Darius, Daniel was mourning, fasting. There appeared to him a glorious person to give him a prophetic history of what should befall his people in the latter days. Prophetic history, chapter 11. That history dealt first with Persia, showing three kings and yet a fourth, richer than they all. It then foretold the coming of a mighty king whose kingdom would be divided after his death. It described the conflict between the kings of the north and they of the south in the centuries ahead, until there should arise one, contemptible in person, but gaining the kingdom by flatteries. The reign of this one, undoubtedly Antiochus Epiphanes, is described at greatest length. The last things foretold, 12:1-3. The last things were then foretold, the coming of Michael and the subsequent time of trouble. Beyond that, the resurrection and the advent of a new age. The closing of the book, chapter 12:4-13. Daniel was charged to shut the book and seal it to the time of the end. In mystic language, he heard the man clothed in linen swear by him that lives, these things should be for a time, times, and a half time. Being filled with a sense of mystery, he asked, what would be the issue of these things? Then the words were shut up and sealed until the time of the end. Then your focus, you have a lot here from Missler on the book of Daniel, and you have some great images for those of you who are into pictures. You have on page 34, you have a map, aerial view, if you will, of the city of Babylon, the Euphrates River going right down the middle of it. You'll have Daniel 9, page 36, the 70 weeks, and you'll get Missler's take on that. And all of the verses involved with that from 36, 37, and 38, and 39. So there's a lot on Daniel 9, 24 through 27 for you to read and to study. Amen.